This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 10th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you this week by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. What we're looking at this week will be some issues that occurred when an S corporation ended up losing its status. We've talked about how fragile S's are before. We'll talk about another way to blow your S status that requires you to pay for a private letter ruling to get it back. We have a case that involved a well-known author who tried to argue that you could divide her royalty income between income subject to self-employment tax and income that wasn't. The tax court eventually didn't go along with that. The IRS brought down the second shoe to drop in the issue of the new withholding under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act scheme they want to be setting up for 2020. We had received a draft W-4 a couple of weeks ago. We have now received a draft of the employer's computations for withholding, and we'll talk a bit about how that's going to work. We had a TIGTA study, the Inspector General's, you know, the Tax Inspector General for Tax Administration, Treasury Administration, it's just Inspector General for Tax Administration, that found how the LBNI, Large Business and Industry Group, a number of penalties they impose for actually related penalties versus those imposed by the Small Business Self-Employed Division. Finally, we'll talk about a case of a filing postmark problem. This issue has come up more than once. This one was actually trying to get a tax court petition in. We've talked about this in the past, but it's good to review the issues as to what you can do to prove timely filing and what you cannot do. And unfortunately, in this case, we had a taxpayer who couldn't prove that their petition was filed on time. Actually, it appears their attorney couldn't prove the petition got filed on time. That created a bunch of problems, as you can guess, because if you don't file your petition on time, well, yeah, you lost your day in tax court. So you don't have an option to go forward at that point. Well, it's that time of year. X marks the spot, right? We're going to be going. Time to kick off. And we're looking here at our tax courses are coming up. For those of you here in Arizona, I'm going to remind you, I have 3 days of courses coming up this week. The 10th, I'll be doing the course Nexus After Wayfair. If you tried to sign up for this and you're listening to this before Monday morning, you tried to sign up for the webcast and it was full, the Arizona Society has opened up new webcast days. You can do that. That's going to be the multi-state taxation problem. I will do the 4-hour ethics course and a 4-hour Arizona income tax course on June the 11th. That'll also be at the Arizona Society offices and also webcast. And on Wednesday the 12th, I will go on the road down Interstate 10 to Tucson. I will be doing Preparing Complex 1040s at the DoubleTree Williams Center, which I think now everybody's gotten used to is a DoubleTree. So we're there at the DoubleTree Williams Center. And again, if you haven't been there for a while, it's what you used to think of as an Embassy Suites. But we'll be doing Preparing Complex 1040s. That will include a session on 199 Cap A. We'll talk about that because that's one of our issues that's on the type of return we do that course. These are the type of issues that are going to show up on 1040s for people who bring their returns to CPA firms as opposed to those who maybe concentrate mainly on storefront approaches. So we'll take a look at that. When I go to New Jersey the following week on June the 19th, we will again do the multi-state taxation course. This will be coming from West Orange, New Jersey, from the Wilshire Grand Hotel, because the New Jersey Society is moving their offices. So we'll not be in the Society offices. If you go there, it's not going to be there. We'll be at the Wilshire Grand, a little distance away in West Orange, not terribly far. The next day, I will be in Shelton, Connecticut, doing Partnership Taxation Advanced Issues on June the 20th. So if you're going to be there, that's available. And then the following week, I go to Portland, Oregon, actually going out to Beaverton. At the Oregon Society offices, I'll be doing fringe benefits on June the 27th, and I'll be doing 199 Cap A qualified business income on June the 28th. Fringe benefits is going to be interesting because obviously we don't know if we will or won't have the Secure Act or whatever succeeds to the Secure Act going through the Congress. I will note this week that it appears Congress has found a way forward on the IRS reform issue. It appears we're going to move a bill that will not have anything about free e-file in it. So that would allow the bill to move forward because that's what was hanging it up. When we'll get such a breakthrough on the Secure Act or if we'll get one remains to be seen. If we get it before June 27th, I already have my stuff ready to talk about what happens to pensions under the Secure Act, but right now it's not the law. So we'll talk about, we'll probably mention the Secure Act changes, but we won't really cover them because we don't know what they'll all be. The following day, on June the 28th, we're going back to our friend 199 Cap A, Qualified Business Income. We'll talk about that Qualified Business Income and more on June the 28th. So we'll talk about QBIM and where we stand on that, including the infamous questions from the IRS website that we've talked about here on this program. And we'll also talk about some of the other business-related changes that were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Keep an eye on your catalog for courses we're going to be doing around the country the rest of the year. We've got courses coming up in other locations as we move through the summer and into the fall. Obviously, the big time for courses always comes after October 15th. But, you know, there's stuff happening now and you're still doing returns. And if you have not kept up with what happened on 199 Cap A since beginning of January, there's been a lot that happened since then. So, you know, come in, check, and we'll talk about those issues. Let's get to our first issue this week. This is a private letter ruling. 2019-22-002 was issued on May the 31st. This is a problem yet again with an inadvertent termination of S-Corp status. Let's talk about how it happened this time. I've mentioned more than once, S-Corps are incredibly fragile devices. If you get a disqualified shareholder, your S-Corporation dies instantly. If you issue a, if you have a second class of stock that is issued, and remember, our definition for second class of stock is not the same as you might find in your state law, corporate law. There's going to be a different definition, but if you have that second class of stock, then you lose your status. Well, this time we had a little different issue. As I mentioned, we only have certain types of shareholders that are allowed. The concept initially for S corporations was that individuals would be the ones who could hold the shares. But Congress said, well, you know, it's not right if somebody dies and their estate holds the share that we should suddenly kill the S election. So estates are allowed in. We also decide eventually that certain trusts, we might want to use a trust for reasons like to prevent that no good son-in-law from taking the shares from our daughter, or our no good daughter-in-law from taking the shares from our son. It doesn't matter whichever way that one works. So we might want to use a trust for that purpose. We might want to be able to use a trust. We'd like it to go to the kids, but we are concerned about distributions to them. So maybe we're willing to pay a high tax rate. So we're allowed certain trusts, you know, qualified subchapter S trust, and also then electing small business trusts. So we had those options. And there are a few others. A testamentary trust can hold it for 2 years. We have certain special rules. But one of the interesting things that happened was, of course, we have these things called limited liability companies. You may remember under check the box, if a limited liability company has only one owner, it's considered to be by default disregarded. We ignore it and we treat the owner as owning it. So if you have a single member LLC that is owned by an individual, we don't look at that LLC as the shareholder for tax purposes. We look at the individual as a shareholder. An individual is an allowed shareholder. So this S corporation, one of these shareholders had his shares in a single member LLC. That's perfectly acceptable, but it creates a potential problem down the line. Eventually, what happens was an interest in that LLC was obtained by another party. We're not told how it was obtained, whether it was purchased, whether the LLC issued new interest, whether there was a gift made, but in some way, shape, or form, we ended up now with two interest holders. Under the check the box regulations, the minute that happens, we go back and say, new entity. I know we haven't changed the entity for tax purposes, or I should say for legal purposes, but for tax purposes, it's a new entity because it can't be disregarded anymore because it has more than one owner. It violated that test. Had elected to be a corporation, it would still be fine, but nope. So we lose that. So it becomes a partnership on the instant that second owner is added. There's a problem. A partnership, what the tax law views as a partnership, is not an eligible S shareholder. So the minute we had a second owner own an interest in this limited liability company, the S corporation election was terminated. Of course, that wasn't noticed originally. And so we operate for a while. We're not told why it was noticed, but as I mentioned before, often it's noticed because a buyer shows up for the company. The buyer does their due diligence. The due diligence teams come back and reports this thing is not an S corporation because it has an eligible shareholder and it has been an S corporation for years. And therefore it has failed to file the C corp returns and it has failed to pay its tax for yay many years. There's all these potential liabilities. Now we've got a problem because if we take over and if we don't buy the stock, we could still be held liable because we're aware, you know, we bought it with this problem inherent and we drained it of its assets by buying the assets from it. And so we participated in this scheme and for whatever reason, therefore the buyer gets nervous. And for the sale to go through, we have to get the IRS to grant inadvertent termination relief. As I mentioned before, generally you can get that. In this case, the taxpayer, the IRS said, we'll treat this as fine as long as you go back, treat it as if it was always owned by this person, and move the shares from the single-member LLC back to the individual that had been disregarded for in the first place. If you do that, then we're fine. We're going to treat it as if we had never lost the S status. But as I mentioned, the way the law is structured, you have to get IRS ruling to get out of inadvertent termination. It's not one of those things that said, if the termination was inadvertent, then aha, it didn't really end. No, it says, if it was inadvertent in the opinion of the IRS, then you're allowed to treat it as if it never went away, but you have to get the IRS's opinion, and that costs money. So the good news was we got a private letter ruling here, and they didn't lose their S status. The bad news was you have to pay the fees for the PLR. And even if the CPA firm does all the work, let's say whoever forgot to notice this, let's say it was a CPA firm or it was the attorneys, whoever, you know, made the mistake of have that LLC get more than one interest holder and didn't realize that killed the S election, whatever professional that was, and I got news for you, they're going to blame the professional. Even if those guys go ahead and eat it, don't charge for the work to shepherd it through, which is going to be a lot of lost time. There'll nevertheless still be a fairly substantial fee for just asking for the ruling paid to the IRS, and they're not waiving that. So it's not cheap. Be very, very, very careful with S corporations, and you want to probably consider asking every year if you have an S corporation, you know, have you done anything? Have the ownership changed? If you have a single member LLC that owns an interest that owns the S corporation shares, you're going to need to ask, did it add any members this year? You know, we want to catch this problem. If we catch it immediately, now it's the client's fault we have to ask for this ruling, not our fault. But if we let it sit there and we go for 10 years and then the buyer shows up, now, unfortunately, because we didn't raise a fuss about it, the client's going to say we were told it was okay. Look, it must have been okay because you filed 10 years worth of returns as an S corporation. And voila, we're on the hook for having to pay to get this thing fixed. You prefer not to be in that situation. Next up, this is the case of Slaughter versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2019-65, issued on June the 4th. Now, interestingly enough, this case, tax analysts kind of, you know, didn't say for sure who this author was, because unusually, the case does not give this person's first name. It just says K. Period Slaughter. However, this is either the worst attempt to hide somebody's identity ever, or it wasn't really that attempt and K's on there for some other reason, or it was the greatest hiding of identity. And there is definitely an author in Georgia that has a real complaint to make against some other author in Georgia, because it certainly looks like we know who this is. So in any event, Slaughter versus Commissioner, this was a case of a well-known author, we're told, who wanted to split her royalty payments into two parts. And she wanted to do this for self-employment tax purposes. And her, you know, and she didn't actually come up with this idea. Her CPA firm came up with this and approached her on doing this. They said, look, she is a brand author. That is, just having her name on the book sells books. We've all seen that, right? You've seen those books. In fact, you know, sometimes the author dies and we continue the series, but you'll still see the book in big letters, you know, having the author's name, and then in, you know, tiny print, inspired by and then written by somebody else. You'll see it come in with that. Or even see it with live authors. You know, you have to be careful sometimes. I've noticed that when buying books, that if you're looking for a particular author, you have to be very careful you don't get an inspired by type book, you know, one of those things. when you're trying to get the author, because, you know, they're a brand author. Well, she's a brand author. And that's clear. Everybody agreed that's it. Now, she said, look, the stuff I do for actual writing, that should be subject to SC tax, but that's like 12, 13 weeks a year. The rest of the time, I'm going out and doing things to build my brand and help the brand and therefore help the publisher based on my brand. And so what I am paid now, because I'm paid a lot more today than I was paid back when I was an unknown author. So a lot of what I'm paid today is for the publisher getting rights to that brand, because that brand has value. Their ability to use my name and to market things with my name, that's a key value that is distinct from being paid for writing. So I'm fine with the writing, my services as a writer being subject to SC tax, but I'm just being myself and being paid for that. And being myself shouldn't be self-employment income. Now, the tax court did not agree. What they had done, that the logic of this one that was used in the case of Slaughter, the CPA firm had found a revenue ruling that goes back a number of years. And what they found in revenue ruling 68-499, that was a case of, and the ruling deals with a case, we have two employees of a taxpayer. These two employees were among five people that had a patent. The employer was paying to the patent holders, each of them, a fee to allow it to manufacture items covered by the patent. This ruling said that the payment to the two employees that represented payment for this patent that they owned personally, was not owned by the company, they owned it personally, those payments for the patent rights were royalty income, not subject to FICA, were royalty payments, not subject to FICA, reported on 1099 miscellaneous, and the payments that were made for the services they were performing, which were separate and distinct, those were wages. The CPA, one of the CPAs who researched this, decided that this should apply for SE tax. So in that CPA's view, the writing was considered to be the equivalent of the services performed by these two patent holders. And the payments for her brand were considered to be the equivalent of the royalty that these two patent holders received. Well, the tax court said, no, it doesn't work that way. They said, first, you've got this wrong. Self-employment tax is not based on the same criteria as employment taxes. Employment taxes are imposed on amounts paid to an employee by an employer for services rendered. Self-employment tax is based on the earnings from a trade or business carried on by the taxpayer. They said, here's the catch. The employees, even though it might have been the same trade or business, right? And obviously it was related. It didn't matter because they were being paid for something that was not services rendered to the employer. However, in this case, the taxpayer was receiving payments, all of which were related to her trade or business as an author. In essence, the publisher would not have been paying for her brand if she was not an author, if it didn't come from her work as an author. So it's all related to the same trade or business. In fact, the tax court pointed out that there have been hobby loss cases where they've used that expectation of increase in reputation or the value of reputation to go ahead and treat it as a trade or business. So the court says this is radically different. So that ruling is inappropriate. It's not the right ruling. It would never apply in a self-employment case. So because of that, we're looking at 1402, 1402A, and 1402A's definition just simply says, does the payment for her brand arise from her trade or business? The tax court said clearly it does. Therefore, it's all subject to SE tax. Now, interestingly enough, this is yet another situation where we're looking at the definition of what is part of a trade or business. So we're kind of back to the same problem we've been looking at, you may guess, under old 199 Cap A issues. It's kind of interesting. The same problems just keep occurring for us. So we're back to trade or business. Now, one nice thing that happened for the author, because she gave the CPA firm all the necessary information, because she got advice from them, and she particularly relied upon their advice for a filing position, The tax court did not impose a penalty on her for the underpayment of tax. Now, I was on another group where somebody asked the question of, well, did the CPA firm get penalized? The answer to that would be, as I said on the group, is first thing is we would never know if that was the case, at least unless the CPA firm was actually penalized and took the matter into a court or some other venue where we could see the case. The other thing to remember is penalties against the preparer are going to be a separate item. They are not going to be handled by the agent handling the case. That would be a conflict of interest that could allow the agent to squeeze the representative, let's say. So bottom line is no, that's not going to be a part of that. It would be a separate item. We do not know. My guess is we don't have enough information to understand, the nature of how they arrived at this. We do know that they had an authority, and merely misinterpreting an authority, unless it's grossly misinterpreted, should probably not be enough to trigger such a penalty. So if you want to know my guess is the IRS probably won't move there because I think it'd be difficult for them to win this case. But again, do we know? No. But certainly, if the IRS looks into this on the preparer's standpoint, the quality of the preparer's records and how they arrived at their decision, the process they used to do it would all be significant in that area. Hey, remember that we had the new W-4? Well, this week we got a draft of Publication 15T, Federal Income Tax Withholding Methods. It was issued on Friday, June the 7th. This is the companion piece to the draft W-4. This provides us with the calculations that we'll be using on the new W-4 after we're given a new W-4 in order to compute the proper amount of taxes to withheld from the employee. This particular form is meant for comments, and you can begin kind of revising your systems to handle this. This is going to be radically different from the old system. It does explain to us, though, how we're going to make the equivalency work. Because remember, the employees don't have to give us new W-4s come January. They can. If they do new W-4s or if they change their W-4s, beginning in January, they've got to use the new W-4 form. But if they don't do that, then we're going to still have the withholding exemptions. What we're going to find out is the way this system works, so you understand basically, we're going to really be working with a calculation. The employer is going to gross up. We're going to basically, the employer is going to compute for the paycheck an annualized earnings based on that paycheck on the pay period. So if you get paid $1,000 in a weekly pay period, we're going to calculate that you're going to be paid $52,000. We're then going to work into your filing status. And we're going to look at, some other information you provide us. What's going to happen is I'm going to compute what your income that we're going to do the withholding based on for the whole year. If you are using in this case, the wage bracket method of withholding, that one where you look it up in the table, then we're going to divide that annual earnings by the number of pay periods again. So we're going to take it back down to a single payroll. And we're going to look that up in the table, and that'll give us the number to withhold. If you're using percentage method, you'll actually compute on the annual amount. Come up with how much you would withhold annually if all the paychecks were the same, and then divide it by that number of pay periods to get how much you take out of this payroll check. So we're going to do it on that calculation. If they keep exemptions, then what you're going to get is an adjustment. That's a flat dollar level adjustment. That's going to be the number of exemptions, right? The number of, so if they claim so many exemptions, you're going to multiply that by a factor and reduce that 52,000 by the factor, then compute. Now, again, remember the employee's been told that they have two W-2s, whether it's one person with two W-2s or a married couple that each has a W-2, then only the high earner is supposed to make most of the adjustments. Okay, there is a special withhold extra box in step 2. And they tell us with these instructions how that's going to work. Okay, that's how this all runs out. So we have this brand new, wonderful system. It takes inputs from the new W-4. Now, what this has in here is the way this thing works. It's a 9-page publication. there are two pages that are instructions. It's like a standard publication. So the front page has the little picture and the title and then some instructions. The instructions drift over onto page two. So there's really probably about a page of instructions to work with. And then they have a full page employer's worksheet to calculate. This is the one you're going to want to look at if you're going to be involved with, let's say, if you're going to hand calculate withholding, how much you're going to withhold, or if you're going to be involved in trying to program a system to do it. You want to look at that page of how it works. And if you're not involved in either one of those, you probably still want to look at it because you're going to advise anybody. And I don't care if you're in industry or you're in public accounting. If you're in tax, somebody's going to walk up to you, even if it's just one of your relatives, and want you to help them fill in their W-4. So you kind of need to know how this thing's going to work. So work through that worksheet. That worksheet takes all of its entries from the W-4. You then have calculations. The next page would have a page of withholding method tables. You have five pages of wage bracket tables. So whichever one of those two you're working with, if I'm working with my family member, I'm probably going to go ahead and use wage bracket tables because I'm going to assume a lot of software will. And it's just going to be a lot simpler than the other way. So I'll go that route. But you're going to do that. After you do that calculation, how much to withhold from the check, because dependency exemptions are now credits, we do go back and figure out how much credit and spread that $2,000 credit over the payrolls or whatever we expect to get. So there is an issue there, and that's a little quirky to handle. If somebody's asking for extra withholding, there are steps you take, and the instructions tell you how to do that. On the wage bracket method, there's actually two columns for each type of, you know, for like single, married, filing joint, head of household. There's actually separate columns. One is the regular column, and one's for the I want extra taken out column. And now it doesn't really say I want extra taken out, but we know that's what it means. And remember, they always can ask at the end to have extra amounts taken out of the paycheck in addition to what you compute. So that number is always put in there. In the handout for this week, handout, PDF, whatever you call it, you can download from the website. We do have a number of examples where I work through this with real numbers, real cases. I'm not going to go through every permutation because that could take forever. But we have a number of them, and I think enough to at least get you comfortable to start playing with the worksheet. One caveat, if you're going to play with the worksheet, the IRS only gave us wage bracket numbers for single filing status. Their theory is doesn't really matter. You know, the others would work the same, so you can do the basic calculations there. And I think they did it weekly, A, because most people don't seem to use weekly payroll, and B, they don't want people using these numbers, so they want to take no chances. They tell you don't use these for anything. And then they tried to make sure and give you something where you didn't have the information to use it for anything unless you went the percentage method. So, yeah, you know, one of those things from the IRS. So we'll see how it goes. But the new methods are out there. They expect to issue in late July what they called near final version of the W-4. I assume that will mean there'll be a near final version of this in July as well. And then in November sometime, they'll issue the actual 2020 version. But the idea is with the July copy, the near final version, that's when people doing payroll system programming are supposed to start coding into this system to make it work so that when they actually get the final adjustments in November, what's going to be the withholding numbers for next year, they'll be able to just plug those in the system. So keep your eye out for that. Next up, we have the Treasury Inspector General's Office for Tax Administration issued a report. It's got a nice title. Few action-related penalties are proposed in large business examinations, and they are generally not sustained on appeal. This is the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration's document number 2019-30-036, issued on May the 31st. Now, what this particular ruling told us was they found is what they said. Now, whether this is or is not a problem is open. But what they found when they did this study was they found that 6%, they looked at how many cases that were finally settled in large business and industry section or the small business self-employed section where there was a tax assessment in excess of 10 grand, was there an accuracy related penalty assessed against the taxpayer that was sustained on appeal, if it was appealed? And they found that only 6% had the LB&I case an accuracy related penalty assessed, while 25% of small business self-employed cases had the penalty assessed. Now, is that good news or bad news? Well, we can talk about it. The IRS said, and so did some practitioners. Tax analysts had in Tax Notes Today on Friday, had an article that went through this as well with complaints by advisors. They're ignoring some key issues. And I think some of that is correct. Some of it may not be, some is, but we'll see how it works. The IRS said, though, there are differences. They did agree, though, the IRS about documentation issues. So one of the things to trip them up on is examiners are always supposed to document their decisions to impose or not impose penalties. And they found a lot of cases had no documentation one way or the other in that regard. And so the IRS agreed there. But the question of is it really a problem that these are different? That's a more interesting case. One problem I have with this is they used a fixed dollar amount. $10,000 in large business and industry cases, probably in many cases, that was not over the limit for the substantial understatement penalty, because a substantial understatement penalty is based on a percent of misstatement. So are you within 10%? Was the amount of tax assessed more than 10% of the amount that ultimately was considered to be due? And obviously, if your total tax liability is $200 million, 10 grand is not close to that number. If your tax liability was, you know, let's say $90,000, then yeah, you know, you're getting there. If you're above 10 grand, we're going to be in problems areas. And 10 grand is a cutoff for a substantial understatement dollar level at small business self-employed. So my guess is the vast majority of SBSE assessments that are above 10 grand are probably getting hit with the automatic substantial understatement penalty. While the flip side of that is, I suspect the large majority of large business and industry exams that are above 10 grand assessed are probably below that limit. And now the burden goes to the IRS if they try to assess that penalty. But also, I'd say part of it, though, probably does relate to a simple fact that large business and industry knows that if they propose a penalty, they're likely ending up in tax court, that those people are likely to fight. They're experienced. They have counsel on retainer. And that they're likely to fight it through appeals. While a lot of the small business self-employed taxpayers, large number of those are probably self-represented, where there's no realistic risk of this assessment ever being challenged. So should that make a difference? Well, arguably no. Does it make a difference? Oh, sure. You know, lots of things happen there, including the simple fact that if a small business self-employed person doesn't appeal or doesn't have any idea how to appeal a penalty, then yeah, it's going to stay on. So I think it's interesting data. I do not think it indicates absolutely that, you know, large businesses are getting away with murder. But it is an interesting difference. And clearly documentation would be nicer for the IRS on these issues. Final case for the week. We're going to take a case at Williams versus Commissioner, which leads me to an aside. Over the years, we've had multiple cases of Williams versus Commissioner, different Williams, but they never do well in tax court. It's just, I'm not sure what it is, but if your last name is Williams, if an IRS exam starts, I would consider going and getting your name changed. Because every time I've looked at a Williams versus Commissioner case, and we've had a number of them, it's never turned out good for the taxpayer. We've talked about too many Williams cases here. So, you know, go get your name changed to Jones or Smith or anything else, right, that goes for that. But Williams seems to be bad, and I don't know why. But this is Tax Court Memorandum Case 2019-66. It was issued on June the 5th. This is a timely mailing, timely filing case. The attorney in question, this is a tax court petition. It was due in the tax court. You know, as always, 90 days after the IRS gave their notice, you have to go ahead and get it to the tax court. Now, in this case, the petition was required to be at the tax court by December 3rd of 2014. The actual petition arrived at the tax court 28 days later in an envelope that had no postmark. Now, the attorney said, well, he knows he put it in the mailbox because he recalled his daughter was scheduled to have surgery on December 3rd. And he remembered that he was rushing to get it done because she was going to be in surgery the next day. And believe it or not, it's usually considered good to be at the hospital if your kid's in surgery. So, you know, we're going to have that. And he said he remembered mailing it that night. So it should have been postmarked on December 3rd. And let's not forget, it's not like an envelope showed up with a postmark of January the 1st or some other date. That clearly would have been later. Now, it is true it didn't arrive until into January, which is suspicious. But, you know, he said, no, I remember it. I'm testifying. Now, there's nothing in the regulations that tell us what to do if there's no postmark on the envelope. The section that covers this, which is Internal Revenue Section 7502, merely provides that if an item is mailed, and if it is mailed before the date on which the document is supposed to be delivered to the Internal Revenue Service, which includes the tax court in this case, it arrives after that date, the postmark date applied by the Postal Service will be deemed the date it was delivered, so it'll be timely. So even though it arrived 28 days later, if there had been a postmark on there that said December 3rd, 2014, it would have been timely. But there wasn't one. And the regs don't tell us what to do if there's not a postmark. We had some discussion what to do with metered mail. We had some discussion of, you know, what to do with other situations. But not what to do if it just doesn't get postmarked. And the tax court said, look, it appears it was delivered by the Postal Service. I love how they said that because, you know, I don't know if they're thinking that somehow the attorney broke in, you know, realized the problem, broke in one night and, you know, stuck the envelope in. There's somehow snuck in, kind of a James Bond move, you know, stuck in and got the envelope in there inside the Postal Service without any, you know, postmark on it. Because it did have stamps on it, just no postmark. But they said, but nevertheless, you know, we're going to assume the Postal Service delivered it. The problem is the burden is on the taxpayer to prove that why it took that extra time to get there. And the court went back. They'd done it before. There seems to be some problem with mailing from Salt Lake City too. This guy was double hit. His name is Williams and the document's being mailed from Salt Lake City because last year, remember, we had two cases from Salt Lake City on postmarks for stamps.com. Okay. But here's the problem. He couldn't show why it wasn't delivered. He said, well, you know, it's a holiday season. I mailed it between Thanksgiving and New Year's. The Postal Service is busy that time of year. So I'm sure it really got all messed up. The court said, you know, we've allowed a few days extra compared to what it should have taken to be delivered. But we've never allowed. And by the way, that is one of the tests the courts have developed. If it has no postmark but arrives within the time that we would expect it to arrive had it been timely mailed, then the court's going to assume it was timely mailed. If it arrives outside that range, you've got to give us an explanation. The court said also the Postal Service, the IRS produced evidence from the Postal Service. Postal employees said if an envelope is actually delayed in the mail or it was like damaged, there should have been some marking on the envelope explaining what happened. And I think we've all seen that before. You ever gotten an envelope that kind of got misdelivered or got damaged in the mail? You know, there's been stuff on it by the Postal Service. And this envelope had none of that information on it. So they said, you know, it should have said if in fact something happened that delayed the delivery, there should have been a Postal Service note about it. There was none. So they're saying that also raises questions about delayed delivery. We also should say the other problem the court had with the attorney's story, and I think this really did hurt, was remember the attorney told us he was writing it the night before. But the problem is, his date of his signature on the petition was November the 29th, not December 2nd. So the idea was this whole story you're writing it for the night before doesn't really make sense because the petition looked appeared to be signed and done on the 29th of November, well ahead of December 2nd. So this story about you being up middle of the night just doesn't really wash with us. Yeah, you know, I think, let's be honest, what the court suspected was it got done on the 29th for whatever reason it didn't get mailed. And it was discovered after the fact that they failed to file a petition and it got stuck in the mail. And for whatever reason, they got lucky and it wasn't postmarked. But, you know, because don't know how you arrange for it not to be postmarked, but it didn't get postmarked and arrived 28 days late. So in any event, they said, we're not sure you proved that. We don't buy that anyway. And it didn't explain how it could have been this delayed. Now, you know, the problem with this is a thoroughly solvable problem. In the article that you can download, we discuss how you solve this. The easiest way to solve this, and there actually are three ways to solve it. There are three ways to prove timely filing. First one is to take the envelope, the U.S. Postal Service, right? And to use either registered or certified mail and keep the receipt. Now, be careful here. I know you're going to want to get that, you know, return receipt requested, the green postcard. The green postcard does not matter. In the documents, if you read it, I've got in there the regulation underlined. What they're telling you to do is the sender's receipt is what the reg mentions. It never mentions a green postcard. It never mentions return receipt. If the sender's receipt is stamped with the postmark date, that is deemed to be the date the document was filed. Or what really happens is the burden shifts entirely to the IRS, who now has to prove what was in that envelope. And more importantly, what wasn't in that envelope. And that's really tough to prove. And I'll be honest, anytime I've had this issue arise, when we've had the certified receipt, the IRS claims that something was laid and we have the certified receipt, the correspondence stops instantly. It's, you know, that's it. It's burden's done. We're over. That is the key filing date. The other two ways to do it, if it's electronically filed document, the date of the electronic postmark obtained from the electronic return transmitter is the date of filing. Now, that's the date the return hit their system, not necessarily the time in which it was transmitted to the IRS. One quirk to remember there, if you have a document that's going to the IRS, while the transmitter's receipt gives us the minute and second of receipt, the taxpayer's time zone is used for the hour and day. So be aware of that, right? The transmitter's, the taxpayer's time zone. So you can't get around this by going that way. And it is the transmitter. Most of you listening to this are the originator, the ERO and the paid preparer, but you're not the transmitter. The transmitter gives you the electronic postmark date. That's the proof of filing. As well, if you use certain specified private delivery services, again, notice 2016-30 has a list of the services. Now, one thing to remember, it's not just enough to use FedEx. You've got to use one of the services listed on the page for FedEx. And the other thing, we had this come a couple of years ago when FedEx added a new next day really, really early service. That really, really early service didn't count until the IRS later revised the list. You've got to only use the services on the list. Don't just look for something that delivers next day. Look for something that delivers next day from UPS, from FedEx, from DHL. DHL was often on the list. But you have to look for one of their services that's on the IRS's list. It doesn't actually have to be next day. Second day delivery actually works in these cases, but it has to be one of the approved services. That's the way you prove it. This was an avoidable issue as long as you use one of those ways of documenting it. By the way, the tax court is more than once commented when people have tried to argue that they did it. You know, we've held attorneys and CPA firms to task. The court has saying, well, you know, you should have known how you do this and get proof. You didn't do that. You took the risk of things not going well. It's registration time. Be sure to register now for your CPE. As I say, I've got courses this week in Arizona. We've got courses coming up in New Jersey and Connecticut the following week, and then Oregon the week after that. Check your state society's CPE catalog. Now, I've got a lot here in June because certain states, not Arizona, but certain states have June deadlines for renewals. So we've got these odd dates we trace, and I've got a few things happening. So we've got those. So, you know, but if you're in Connecticut, New Jersey, Oregon, or if you get this quickly enough, Arizona, you know, take a look at those courses. I'd be glad to see you there. Two of the Arizona courses, the first two this week, the multi-state taxation is actually the three, and the Arizona tax and Arizona ethics courses are going to be webcast. The other courses I'm doing, as I recall, are not being webcast. I'm not totally sure about the ones in Oregon, but I do know the courses in New Jersey, the course in New Jersey is not being webcast. Neither is the one in Shelton. The court in New Jersey will start webcasting, I understand, but right now, they're still waiting to move offices. So, yeah, you know, the hotel, we're not going to try that. That's really tricky if you ever try to webcast from a hotel. Tried that a couple of times. It gets really interesting sometimes. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 10th, 2019. You can follow our updates online as things happen during the week. I'll try to write up updates on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, Ed Zollers, at currentfiletaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Ed Zollers. And I also follow discussions on the subreddit, reddit.com/r/taxpros. I follow discussions on the Connect websites for the Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota societies of CPAs. And I look in from time to time to Tax Talk for CalCPA. That's a Yahoo Groups site. That one, unlike the Connect sites that are going to be limited to the members of those societies, the Tax Talk site for CalCPA is open to any CPA around the country. So if you got nowhere else to go, you can go there. Check your own state society to see if they offer a similar option. A number of them do. Or check in to CalCPA or on the Tax Pros site on Reddit. And with that, we'll see what happens this week. You know, we got two bills that are kind of in weird shape in the Senate, one of which may actually be moving now, though, the IRS, the IRS reform bill. And so we'll see what happens there. We'll look at our developments. We're still waiting on a bunch of proposed regs, including the proposed regs made it out of OIRA this week on the state tax credit issues that we have for the state and local tax deduction. You know, if we make a contribution to a state tax credit organization that gives us a credit against our state income taxes, if we give to a certain charitable organization, do we still get charitable deduction? Those regs are due to be out, we're told. At least OIRA's kicked them back to Treasury. So we'll see what happens there. So if anything happens this week, we're going to hopefully tell you what happened and come back here a week from now and discuss the developments under current federal tax developments.